Okay, I'm going to send them this away. So I'll do this one more time. Then the quiz before the exam will be at the vocabulary quiz. You might remember we're going to have a quiz on those vocabulary terms. Kind of a matching quiz. Here, I'll take them as I go. Okay. So, oops. So for the first question, I think it's the easier of the questions. The idea is to start by drawing the meridian. That's the line in the sky that goes from north to the north celestial pole through zenith and back through south. So here's the meridian. So here I am standing right under zenith, and here's north and here's south. So we're in Florida, so the north celestial pole isn't going to be very high. It's just going to be equal to the latitude, which is 25 degrees, we said. And the celestial equator goes the other way. It goes from exactly east to exactly west. So it has to cross the meridian at some point. And what is true is the celestial equator misses zenith by your latitude. So the star has a declination that says go 45 degrees towards the north celestial pole. 45, 46. And then we're supposed to calculate its altitude. And the altitude is the angle above the nearest horizon, which is in this case the north horizon. So that's the angle we're going to want to calculate. And there are, you know, typically lots of ways of doing it. What I kind of see immediately is that this angle here, I can calculate because it's 46 minus 25. It's what's missing when I take out the 25. And then, since this is a right angle, this angle is going to be 90 minus 21, or 69 degrees. So the other problem has to do with figuring out when this is going to happen. So we need some marker for when's, and the marker is noon, because we know the sun is on the meridian at noon. So on March 21, the sun would be at the vernal equinox. Here we are at April 21. The sun is going to have moved over about 2 hours of right ascension. Right? It's got to go around 24 hours of right ascension in 12 months, so it's going at a rate of 2 hours per month. So apparently the sun has a right ascension that's equal to about 2 hours. And our meridian is going to be swishing by at a rate of 2 hours of right ascension per hour of time. You can think about that as the Earth spins, what's straight up is going to change. So if we start out knowing the particular time, noon, the right ascension that's on the meridian is 2 hours, all we have to do is work our way forward until we hit 5:05. We could also do it backwards, but it's obviously going to be a lot shorter to go forwards. So at 1 p.m., this is going to be 2. At 2 p.m., this is going to be 3. At 3 p.m., this is going to be, only 1-3 in a row. 2-4, this is going to be 5. And we want to be just a little bit beyond that. 5 hours of right ascension in 5 minutes. So that's going to happen at 3:05 p.m. Okay, questions on that process? Tom?
So sun's right ascension on a given day, or also supposed to know those?
Yeah, so you should memorize that table that has the sun's location on the equinoxes and the solstice.
Okay.
So on March 21, so March 21, that's the equinox that defines zero for right ascension. It's kind of like Greenwich, England. So here we are 1 month later, 2 hours per month, it's going to be at 2. Okay, more questions? So there are more of these practice things online, and to find them, what you want to do is to click on the link that says lectures.mp4, and right in the first folder, you'll see a bunch of files that are screencasts titled something like culminateA.mp4 and culminateB.mp4. And there may be, I don't know, 8-10 examples that are done in those, combined in those screencasts. Okay, so one more shot at this before the exam. Between the exam and that last shot, we'll do the vocabulary quiz. But also before the exam, we want to kind of think about a time we have an option to get together and ask questions. So I sure hope I see lots of you in my office asking questions. And for sure, the best way to study for the exam is to go look at the old exams that are online. So both the one for 212 and 211 are covering pretty much the same thing at the beginning. So take a look at those old exams and actually work those problems and bring them into my office and we can talk about your answers. I'm sure that's the best way to prepare. But talking together is good too. So typically people want to do this the day before or the day before the day before the exam. And typically they're going to do this before dinner or after dinner. So I think those are kind of the main options that we'll vote on. So, I don't know, let's do the before dinner, after dinner question first. So who's for before dinner? Say at 4 or something like that. 1, 2, 3. And who's for the 4, 5? Who's for the after dinner? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's actually pretty close, but I think that the after dinner won. Does anyone have any particular times after dinner that are better than any other times? Want to nail it down. Everything's the same?
7.
Bus schedule. Should we make it 7:30? 7:15? Any quiet? No one really cares.
What date is this?
So it's either going to be the day or the day before. Probably it's going to be either Thursday or Wednesday of next week. You want to decide on that first? Who's for the day before the exam, Thursday? 0. Who's for Wednesday? Okay, so Wednesday at something like 7:30, 7:15, 8, 8:15. Any time better for anyone than any other time? 7:15, I heard. So 7:15 Wednesday. Here. And a good way often it's hard to find questions to ask. Again, take a look at the old exams and then you'll maybe have some questions to ask. And I think there are also screencasts with the answers to those old exam questions. If you go into the appropriate year. So go into so this is all under lectures. So go into 212 and then go into last year, 2011, and there'll be a screencast that describes the solutions to the first exam. And then do the same thing, go to 211, and there'll again be a screencast that has the answers to the exam then. And you'll see the exams are pretty similar. And your exam obviously won't be identical to one of those exams, but I think you'll be surprised how similar it'll be. I guarantee there'll be lots of repeated questions.
What's the test format?
So exactly like these, and the format is 20 true false, 15 short answer, and 5 10-point questions. And one of your 10-point questions will be this one. Questions? So you did a Name That Moon quiz, I hope, for today's class. And that's where there were pictures of moons and you had to say whether it was white on the right and therefore was a waxing whatever. And if it was white on the left, it was going to be a waning whatever. So we have what people typically find a harder quiz is the one just below it. It's just labeled Moon Quiz. And that has stick figures and dome of the sky sorts of situations where you have to say what you would see if the moon were at this particular spot. And that's what we'll do for next time. And we're going on to chapter 4. Be the last chapter I think we'll cover before the exam. So we're kind of working our way down understanding how the sky works. And we've been talking mostly about what I would call phenomena, just the data. How do things move in the sky? And I've tried to avoid giving any reason for why that's the way it works. So reasons for why things work, we usually call a model. And that's what we'll be talking about today, some old-fashioned models, because I think it helps to understand old-fashioned models before we go on to new ones. And once we have a model, people typically think that the model explains or helps us understand the phenomena. But I know that's a little bit different from believing in that model and saying whether that model is actually true in some big sort of sense. So what we did last time, as I say, was mostly we're talking about the data. How do these things seem to work? And the sun is the thing that has the most. So first of all, the whole celestial sphere is extremely regular, right? Every star rises and sets, same spot, goes around our sky in pretty much one day. Incidentally, it's not exactly one day. It's 23 hours, 56 minutes in order for the celestial sphere to make one full rotation. And the reason why it's a little bit less than 24 hours is we arrange our watches so that they work according to the sun's position, not the star's position. So we want at 1 p.m. the sun to be in pretty much the same spot, whereas we don't care whether Rigel is in the same spot at 1 p.m. And of course, the sun is a moving target. The sun starts the day there, and the next day it's there. So the celestial sphere has to make a little bit more than a full rotation to get the sun back at the same spot. So the celestial sphere makes a full rotation itself in 4 minutes less than 24 hours, and then it takes 4 minutes more in order to catch up to the moving location of the sun. Okay, so 5,000 visible stars have perfectly regular motion. And we have a variety of objects which typically are pretty bright, but don't follow the exact behavior of the 5,000 stars that we can see. And the Greeks called these objects that were not moving exactly regular planets. So to the Greeks, the sun and the moon were planets. And I'll sometimes use that that vocabulary. So the sun has a very stable path. Aside from the stars, it's the next most stable object. So it's moving around the ecliptic. The ecliptic doesn't change over millions of years. The one thing that's a little bit uneven about it is that it turns out it's moving a little bit faster than normal when it's about here. January 4, 5, it's moving a little bit faster than it is on average. Not a lot, just a few percent faster, but measurable to the Greeks long ago. So the moon probably has the next most regular behavior. The path that it takes isn't regular enough to be put on this sort of chart because it's gradually precessing. It's a great circle, very similar to the ecliptic, but it's inclined to the ecliptic by about 5 degrees or so. And the precise points where the plane of the moon's orbit and the plane of the sun's orbit intersect, that's called the line of nodes. So we have this sort of situation. This is an explanation, which we don't really need yet, I guess. So the phenomena is that the sun is illuminating the moon, and so what we see of the moon changes. And if things were right, if the moon were up now, what we'd do is we'd go outside, and if you could just hold a ball at the position that the moon is at in the sky, you would see that the ball would have exactly the same amount of illuminated surface as the moon has. So nothing special is going on in causing the phases of the moon, except that it's a sphere that is being illuminated by the sun. And it doesn't matter whether that sphere is 3 feet in front of your eyes or a quarter of a million miles away, it's still going to work pretty much the same way. So we have this phenomena where what matters is the angle between the sun and the earth and the moon. That determines the phase. So if here's the earth and here's the sun and here's the moon, this angle being about 45 degrees guarantees you that you're going to have a moon that has white, roughly speaking like that, halfway between being a first quarter phase and being a new moon. And we went through where all of these moons were at various times of the day. And everything's just being controlled by this increasing angle between the sun and the moon. So if you know that angle, you should be able to figure out where the moon is in the sky and what fraction of it's going to be illuminated. What happens occasionally is that the moon is in the same direction as the sun. Usually nothing special happens. The shadow of the moon misses the earth. But if things are lined up on one of these lines of nodes, then we can have the shadow of the moon hit the surface of the earth. And what that means from the earth is that we suddenly see this, suddenly is an overstatement. Over a few hours, we see bigger and bigger bites being taken out of the moon until finally the center of the moon and the center of the sun line up. It can be the case that the moon doesn't completely cover the sun. So that means you're going to see this ring of fire surrounding this black hole. So that's called an annular eclipse. That happens about half the time. So not the other half of the time, the sun will be more than covered up by the moon, and then we have a total eclipse. And since the very bright part of the sun has been covered up, it'll get very dark. And you will just have this kind of very dull ring of the atmosphere of the sun visible, called the corona, which we'll talk about eventually. Okay, so other possibilities if we're off the total eclipse line is we'll just see a bite out of the sun. So these are partial eclipses. And you can see that, kind of from the geometry, that only a very small fraction of the Earth is going to be lucky enough to experience a solar eclipse. Most people won't. So this line as this dark spot of the moon as the Earth spins and the moon moves, it's going to sweep across the surface of the Earth. And typically at any one location, there'll be just a few minutes where the sun is fully obscured. Okay, that's in contrast to lunar eclipses. So when the moon moves into the shadow of the Earth, turns out the Earth is bigger than the moon, so the shadow is always bigger than the moon. So it's going to take many hours for the moon to move through this region of darkness, and everyone on the night side of the Earth will be able to see the corresponding phenomena. Okay, so most regular sun, next most regular moon, and we have these phenomena of eclipses that happen occasionally. They happen typically twice a year in what are called eclipse seasons. That is to say, when the sun is near a line of nodes and only on those dates can you have eclipses. Typically you get two close together eclipses, one lunar and one solar, and then 6 months later it all reoccurs. The fact that the line of nodes moves tells you that this eclipse season is going to gradually change with time, happening a little bit earlier every year. Okay, so there are two inferior planets, Mercury and Venus, and they never get very far from the sun. And since they never get very far from the sun, they're typically going to be seen at sunrise and sunset. So here's kind of a typical situation at sunset. In order to see such a Venus, it has to be on that side of the sun. And you can figure that out just by holding up your star chart and seeing that if the sun is at the horizon, then that Venus will be below the horizon. If Venus is on the other side of the sun, then we're not going to see it at sunset, we're going to see it at sunrise. And if we were to follow the behavior of Venus over a few months, we would see that it's on one side of the sun, it catches up and passes the sun, then it comes back again to the other side. So it's alternately an evening star and a morning star. The thing that kind of typifies this behavior is the maximum angle of elongation. What is the biggest possible angle between the sun and, say, Venus? It's about 45 degrees in round numbers. And for Mercury, it's about 30 degrees. So Mercury is substantially harder to see, both because it's dimmer and because it's closer than the sun. Venus, so if you see a bright dot at sunset, it's almost certainly Venus. If you look for Mercury, you really have to go out of your way to look for it. It doesn't look particularly obvious, just looks like a more or less dim star. And soon after that, it sets. So it's much more difficult to see Mercury than to see Venus. The superior planets, and of course we know there are planets beyond Saturn, but the Greeks didn't know there were planets beyond Saturn. They have, I guess I'd say even odder behavior. So first of all, generally speaking, everything's going the same way as the sun is going, the moon, the sun, the planets. But the superior planets are going slower. So that means if this is a superior planet, what's going to happen is that the sun is going to pass by it. So we're going to have the phenomena that we see, for example, Jupiter now in the evening sky. But in a few months, Jupiter will disappear from the evening sky, and it'll reappear in the morning sky. Okay, so slower, more or less on the ecliptic. But then they have this other odd behavior that when they are 180 degrees from the sun, they give up moving in the normal direction and they move backwards for a while. So motion of these superior planets is two steps forward and one step back, where these steps back are happening all the time at opposition when the sun is 180 degrees from the object. So Jupiter and Saturn go slow enough that typically you're going to have this retrograde period pretty much once per year. For Mars, since it's more of a moving target, it happens more like once every 2 years. Okay, questions? I want to say two words. I'm trying to avoid talking about explanations as much as possible, but some things kind of don't wait easily. I keep talking about the sun moving, and you know that it's not really the sun that's moving, it's the Earth that's moving. So what's happening is as the Earth goes around in its orbit, the sun seems to be in various constellations. Okay, so this is the, I don't know, truth. But it's kind of not where we're going to start. So where we are going to start is with the actual, well, let's flash this transparency first. So we got a bunch of dead people that we want to talk about. And you can see these dates are spanning basically 500 BC to 100 AD. And this is a period of time when the Greeks and Roman culture took over about here, so a lot of these so-called Greeks were actually Romans, and a lot of them didn't live in Europe. They lived in, for example, Egypt. But usually they fall under the general name of Greeks. And here we're starting at 424 BC, but you should realize that there's history before that. And one of the problems, of course, is that we don't have good representations of that history. But we do know that Babylonian cultures also very carefully track the location of the planets, but we kind of don't know what they thought about it. So these guys were basically philosophers, and they gave us speculation as to what would be causing these apparent motions of the sky. And we have a fair representation. A whole lot of stuff is missing from, more than 2,000 years ago. I guess that's no surprise that books have been lost. But we do have a pretty good representative set of what these guys were up to and what they were maybe thinking is the wrong word, at least writing about how the heavens moved. So I hope a lot of these names are well known to you from other studies, right? Plato and Aristotle are huge figures in the history of Western civilization. So, and of course, Socrates too. It's maybe worth commenting that Socrates, we don't have any writings from Socrates. So pretty much everything, the so-called Socratic dialogues, probably actually written by Plato. So although we think that those dialogues probably give us a good idea of what this guy Socrates was about, it's a little bit less than perfectly clear. And none of those dialogues deal with astronomy. So that's why Socrates didn't make it on this list. So the overall kind of idea of Plato was that the world we live in is kind of a pale reflection of a more perfect reality that actually exists. So that perfect spheres, et cetera, actually exist in some real sense. Whereas today we'd say that a perfect sphere is an imaginary mathematical object. Plato would say that they actually existed, and our knowledge of them is basically memory of a previous life. And this idea was put into, so he speculated that the perfection of the circles meant that they actually existed, and he didn't work out the details, but you can't help but notice that the stars seem to be attached to this celestial sphere, and the celestial sphere seems to be turning at an exactly uniform rate. So 5,000 objects, 5,000 phenomena, the daily rising and setting of all these suns, is explained by thinking that this perfect sphere actually exists and that the stars are attached to it. So Plato knew about these seven exceptions that didn't seem to be doing exactly the same thing year after year after year, what he would call the planets. And he more or less speculated that you could describe their behavior as also being perfectly circular motion, but circular motion relative to something that was itself moving. So these are the spheres of the planets. Eudoxus was his student, and he took the task in hand to actually calculate what set of spheres would be required in order to make this system work. And we end up with, not exactly with Eudoxus, but particularly after Aristotle, with a system in which the idea was kind of as follows. Well, so before I flash that, let me remind you of what the actual data is. And I hope that will convince you that these are reasonable explanations. Right? So we actually have the data that Ptolemy has of Saturn in 133 AD, and here you can see Saturn going through this sort of loop. And time after time after time, it would do this pretty much at opposition. So here's data that is much more recent, 1700s, that shows similar sorts of behavior. So if you see this apparent motion in the sky, by far the most obvious way to explain it is with something like this. So the idea is, well, a planet isn't moving on a perfect circle, but it's moving on a perfect circle which is itself on a perfect circle that is moving. And if you have that combined motion, you can get this sort of thing. So everything's still circles, but now we need more than one. But we got 5,000 objects which are perfectly circle. We got these 9 exceptions. You know, kind of, what's the big deal? Still perfect circles every place. So here's the overall setup that we've got for the Ptolemaic system. Let me again flash this transparency. So you see that Ptolemy is at the end of this line of people. So he was relying on the observations of all of these guys, and he really had the details perfectly right. So he wrote the book, which we know as the Algemast, which, you know, maybe this is as good a time as any to talk a little bit about how we know about any of these guys, because it's not in the obvious fashion. What separates us from these guys is the Dark Ages, and the Dark Ages really were dark. Their books were lost. So a good fraction of the way we know about these guys is from a highly indirect way. So the culture that was flourishing while we were cleaning out stables in Europe was the Arabic culture. So the Arabs took over all of this learning and advanced it. And then circa 1300, that learning was reintroduced into Europe via Spain. Spain was Arabic at the time. And so there was a huge group of people translating what were originally Greek books but had been translated into Arabic back into Latin so that people could actually read them. Okay, so that's why this kind of funny name for this Greek book. This is the Arabic name that we know this book by. But Ptolemy wrote his book in Greek, and kind of by this indirect process, we came to learn about it. Okay, so this is kind of the ultimate, the final textbook in this long line of astronomers who were in the business of trying to explain this motion. So, Eudoxus, he's using just circles, and he's more a philosopher than a scientist, and it more or less works. But as you got better and better observations, you needed a better and better theory. So things got more and more complicated with time. And here's kind of the ultimate system that Ptolemy came up with. So it's circles within circles. So this is the main circle is the deferent, the secondary circle is the epicycle. But it turns out that circles within circles just doesn't exactly cut it. And we need some kind of special mechanism in order to get the planets in the right spot at the right time. And the main thing that he used was called the equant. And this was an argument that, in fact, the Earth wasn't the center of the circle. The Earth was off-center a little bit. And there was this magic point called the equant that was as far from the center as the Earth was. And the way this needed to work is that you thought about, say, a line going from the equant to the deferent that was moving at an exactly uniform rate. And that's pushing the center of the epicycle along. Okay, so it seems complicated, but you need something like this to make it work. So here's the center of the circle, here's the Earth, and here's the equant. And we're thinking about, here's, for example, the Sun. The Sun doesn't need an epicycle. So here we have the Sun that's being pushed along at the equant. And you can see that if this thing is moving at a constant number of revolutions per year, as it were, RPMs, then what's going to happen is that because it's close to the equant here, the Sun is going to be moving relatively slowly. Whereas here, 6 months later, same number of RPMs, but we're further out on the radius, the Sun is going to be moving faster. So this game of equant is exactly what you need in order to make the Sun seem to be going faster at this January 4 sort of date. Okay. Kind of a quick comment on that. So we've been talking about these standard dates of March 21, June 21, September 21, December 21. And it sounds like they're the same number of days between all of those times. So it sounds like the motion is uniform. But if you actually count the number of days, right, there are fewer days between, there are fewer days between December 21 and March 21 than there are for the other ones, because the Sun is moving a little bit faster, right, in good part due to February. Okay, so we have this, I don't know if this seems overly complicated to you or not, we have this moderately complicated system, and here's kind of the full story. So the idea, we know that Mercury and Venus don't get very far from the Sun, so the idea was that the ray that is pushing the Sun around is also pushing the centers of the epicycles for Venus and Mercury around at the same rate. So they're never going to stray very far from the Sun. And here we have the epicycles for Mars and Jupiter and Saturn. And out here we have the celestial sphere that is moving exactly perfectly. So Eudoxus, well actually Plato for that matter, but Eudoxus kind of had the idea that that it was this outer sphere that was kind of causing this motion of these planets. And the idea that was put forward particularly by Aristotle is that things were perfectly going far from the Earth And as we get closer and closer to the earth, things are getting worse and worse and worse. So here on earth we have decay. Out in the heavens we don't have decay, right? The stars seem to be eternal and unchanging. So how to explain that? Well, Aristotle talked about four elements, right? Earth, air, water, and fire. And these elements were all subject to change. Whereas the heavens were made out of a different element that wasn't subject to change, the so-called quintessence. And kind of the moon was the boundary between the region where we had decay and death, and the region where we had eternal, almost perfect motion, to the region where we have eternal, perfect motion. Okay, so it's a system that makes sense and works pretty well. So if you want to cast a horoscope for what's happening 100 years in the future, you can use this system really well. And you'll get answers that aren't perfect, but you know, they're probably within your pinky of the right answer. But the devil kind of is in the details, and you know, as these guys learn more and more and more, the story became increasingly complicated. So you remember we talked about how the pole is actually changing, the Earth's pole. So we would interpret that as the changing location of the changing direction of the Earth's spin axis. But for these guys, it was the whole celestial sphere changing. So Hipparchus was the first guy to figure that out. We actually don't have any written work from Hipparchus, so everything we know about Hipparchus is reported by his contemporaries, who are saying, you know, what a great astronomer Hipparchus is. So he's usually assumed to be the greatest astronomer of early times. I want to talk a little bit about Aristarchus, because he had a different point of view. And his point of view was, well, let me back up for a second and comment on one reason that this system probably doesn't make a lot of sense to us is we think about all of this stuff in the universe revolving. You know, how does it get in motion, right? Getting something in motion seems to be hard to do. But with this idea of the quintessence, it was a fifth element that didn't require anything to move it. It weighed nothing, and you got it moving, and it would move forever in a straight line. So the possibility that the heavens were anything like the earth was kind of out of bounds for these early Greeks. But Aristarchus had kind of a different take on it, I think in part because he was one of the first guys to actually get some idea about the relative size and distance to the sun and the moon. So using some pretty tricky geometry and some not particularly accurate measurements, so his answers weren't accurate by modern standards, but he did come to the correct conclusion that the sun is way bigger than the earth, the moon is smaller than the earth, and the sun is way further away than the moon is. So if you come to the conclusion that the sun is bigger than the earth, it's kind of natural that things should be going around the sun and not the earth. So this alternative point of view, as opposed to the universe being centered on the Earth, a geocentric system, Aristarchus put forward the idea that the sun was the center of the solar system, a heliocentric system. And then we have exactly the sort of idea that we have today, where the cause of the motion of the stars is in the rotation of the Earth, and the apparent change in location of the sun is actually due to the orbit of the Earth. So Aristarchus had all of those ideas right. So why didn't what he say catch on? Well, what's the evidence? What's the evidence that the Earth is moving? It doesn't seem to be moving. So Aristotle comments that if the Earth were actually moving, rotating at thousands of miles an hour, how could it be that the birds could catch up with the Earth? common experience is that if you get something in motion that on the Earth, it comes to rest after a short period of time. So why does the Earth spinning continue? So there are all these kind of pretty good arguments against Aristarchus' point of view, but one argument stands out today, and that's the argument about parallax. So parallax had been part of the ability to measure the distance to the moon. And let's start by talking about that. This isn't actually how Aristarchus did it, but it was how people after Aristarchus did it. So if you think about a rotating Earth, where I am in space is different 6 hours later. And so if I have something nearby, when I look at it now, it's going to be seem to be at a different location than when it's going to be 12 hours later. All right, so if you stick your thumb in front of your nose, I can line up my thumb with you, and if I switch eyes, my thumb seemed to have moved. So this is called parallax. And if you know how far something seems to move, and you know the distance, you've got a triangle and a side, and you can calculate the distance to that object. And I hope it's clear that if something's close, it moves a lot. If something's far away, it doesn't move as much. So the bigger the parallax, the closer the object is. Well, this is kind of small change for distances, right? If the Earth is actually going around the Sun, then we're talking about a much bigger circle. A circle that's roughly 200 million miles in diameter. And so if things are in different distances, they should show parallax. And people looked for this for the stars, and they couldn't detect any parallax. It's as if the Earth was moving millions of miles and the stars weren't moving at all. So if we move and the stars don't move, the obvious conclusion is that we're close to the center. And there is no motion. So Aristarchus put forward his arguments, which were based kind of on the idea that the stuff that the sky is made of is the same as us. And heavy stuff should be at the center, not the light stuff. But he's contradicted by the non-observation of parallax. So he's pretty much not believed. I don't think we have actually Aristarchus' original work. We have mostly the work of other people criticizing his idea. So let's talk a little bit about Eratosthenes. And what he's famous for is getting the radius of the Earth. So, I don't know, sometimes I run into people who have been kind of mistaught in grade school, and they've been told that Columbus was afraid he was going to fall off the edge of the Earth because it was flat. I don't know if you've been told that or not, but that's emphatically not true. Way back to Plato, people have known that the Earth was a sphere. And there are lots of ways of recognizing that. The easiest way is to look at the shadow of the Earth. So when the moon is moving into the shadow of the Earth, we can see that the shadow of the Earth is curved. Another way you can test that out is by looking at sailing boats. So as a boat sails away, what we miss first is the hull. We can see the tip of the sail, and finally the thing disappears. So if the Earth were flat, it wouldn't work that way, right? Maybe it would get foggy and you'd not see the whole ship, but there'd be no reason for the top of the ship to stay around longer than the bottom of the ship. So, you know, for 2,000 years, people have known that the Earth was a sphere, and in particular, Columbus certainly knew that the Earth was a sphere. He had no worries about falling off some sort of edge of the Earth. So if it's a sphere, a good question is, what's the radius? How big is the Earth? And Eratosthenes had the idea as follows. So the sun is way out here, and he knew that on a particular day, the sun was directly overhead at a particular location. Whereas at some distance away, there was a shadow. So he could calculate the angle that you had to go through over this distance. And if you know that this angle is to this distance, then you can calculate by proportions for a full circle, what's the full circumference? And I'm tempted to say that Eratosthenes got the answer quite accurately correct. It's a little bit difficult to say that because he gives us the answer in stadium, and we're not exactly sure how big a stadia is. And in fact, not uncommonly, people calculate the size of a stadia by taking his measurement of the Earth and the known radius of the Earth and just dividing them. But he certainly got the answer pretty correct, and the method is perfectly correct. Since Eratosthenes, we've had good estimates for the size of the Earth. So that kind of begs the question, how did Columbus get it wrong, right? So Columbus said, I can get to China a lot faster if instead of going east, I go west. And it ain't so, right? From Spain, it's a lot faster to go the other way. So he had a wrong estimate for the radius of the Earth, and this is something where Ptolemy did get it wrong. Ptolemy did not believe Eratosthenes' measurement of the Earth. He had his own way of doing it, and unfortunately it was wrong by about a factor of two. Okay. So what I'm trying to convince you is that this idea about how the heavens work, with its idea that the Earth is subject to decay, the heavens move in these perfect circles, works pretty well. It makes sense. If you try and introduce the idea of a sun-centered universe, it really doesn't fit. It's kind of properly rejected based on the data. There's no parallax. And Aristotle's point of view actually encompassed everything. Aristotle had a full understanding of, well, maybe I shouldn't say a full understanding. He had a full explanation for how everything worked in the universe. So taking a pot shot at this relatively small aspect of it in astronomy seems to be the wrong approach. Okay. You know that we don't believe those guys anymore. So the question is, how did we come to our present understanding? What's the history that's involved in coming up with this idea that the geocentric model that goes back to Aristotle is in fact incorrect, and that instead of the sun going around the Earth is going around the sun? How do we get these kind of crazy ideas? So here's a little bit of the timeline when this was all figured out. Right. Roughly speaking here, 100 years when people went from believing in this geocentric model to when people started believing in a heliocentric model. As you may know, it took the Catholic Church a while to believe this, so we have to go into the 1850s or so before the Catholic Church accepted this point of view. So the name that's usually associated with this is Copernicus. So this change from an Earth-centered model to a sun-centered model is often called the Copernican Revolution. And I'm going to kind of downplay Copernicus. There are lots of people on this list that I like better than Copernicus. There's one kind of overall important thing to keep in mind, and I hope that there are lots of names on here that you should recognize from your liberal arts background. And this is the problem. One of the reasons this all took so long. So you know that there's this huge fight between Luther and what became Lutheranism and the Catholic Church. It was a bad time to have new ideas. Incidentally, Lutheran was no supporter of Copernicus, so it wasn't as if Luther was on one side and the popes were on the other. It was just a bad time to have new ideas. People who had new ideas were prone to be burned either by the Lutherans or the Catholics. And in fact, oddly enough, the history of Copernicus. Copernicus himself was a figure in the Catholic Church, but his book was published actually by a Lutheran. So, as I say, this wasn't fundamentally an argument about religion, but it was a bad time to have any sort of argument. So it turns out that as he was, Copernicus had these ideas that, you know, that you're familiar with from grade school, that this is the system. Right? That we got the sun at the center, we've got these planets. The Earth really isn't any different from the other planets. Everyone's going around the sun. It all makes a certain degree of sense. He probably had that idea kind of in the middle of his life, but he held off publishing it until literally on his deathbed. So his famous book was published just at that time. But if you look at his book, it's filled with oddities, and I don't know, people tend to have a wrong idea about it. So the first thing I want to try and correct about the Copernican Revolution is it doesn't do a better job. If you're trying to figure out where Mars is going to be on December 31, 2020, you can do this just fine. There's no greater accuracy in doing this funny loop-de-loop stuff than doing, you know, what we say is right. It's not more accurate. Now, I hope it's clear that these days we can be extremely accurate about the location of these planets, right? We can land a spacecraft on Mars within a mile out of millions of miles. So we know the precise position. We know the position of the moon to within centimeters. So there's no doubt that currently we can do a better job, but Copernicus couldn't. And basically the reason Copernicus didn't do a better job is because he was still caught up with circles. Right? Aristotle had taught everyone that we expect perfect motion in the heavens and circles should be expected. So basically all Copernicus did is we had all of these epicycles and deference that were trying to explain the motion of the planets. He just declared that this one was at rest, but everything else was still the same. So it was still circles within circles within circles. Furthermore, for reasons that are, well, I'll talk about them, I guess, in a second, he didn't like this equant idea. So in addition to keeping with circles, he got rid of this equant, and it turns out the equant works really well. If you're trying to explain the uneven motion of the Earth or the Sun, take your pick, this is a really great approximation. And throwing out the equant made his whole system basically worse, and he kept with circles, which weren't right in the first place. So as a matter of fact, his system was no more accurate than the system that had been around for 2,000 years. Okay, so if it's not more accurate, you know, why believe it? Right? Still no parallax measurement, so there's no good reason to believe it. And it was basically a philosophical argument that the sun was this big, bright, extremely important object for the Earth, right? You turn off the sun and everything's over here. And it kind of makes sense for that object to be at the center of the solar system. So it's not fundamentally an argument about, you know, where the planets seem to be in the sky, because it doesn't do any better at that. And it's not an argument about Aristotle's fundamental ideas, namely that circular motion is perfect and it should be expected in the heavens, because he kept all of those things. It's really fundamental idea prejudice about what should be the center of the solar system. And again, Aristotle's argument, the sun's nothing. It's just made of quintessence. It has no problem going around the Earth every 24 hours. But if you believe that the sun is anything like the Earth, then it's this big, massive thing. It's going to have mucho problems going around the Earth. Whereas the Earth is this little ball it's not going to have that sort of problem. So how do we resolve this problem? We've got two theories. We've got Ptolemy's theory that goes back to Aristotle. It's got a long history. And we've got the upstart model, Copernicus. They do about the same level of prediction in the sky. The differences are more philosophical than actually based on data. So, I don't know, how to resolve this issue. And to me, so heroes are often not exactly straightforward. I was about to say one of the heroes in my mind is Tycho Brahe, except personally he was a bastard. But he did great work, not uncommon combination. So Tycho's story is that he had the idea that you should resolve this difference by getting good data. So for years, well, for millennia, people had been noting, you know, roughly speaking, where Mars is, say, to within the size of your finger, which is good enough for ordinary, way good enough for ordinary purposes. But he had the idea of doing the best possible job you could. And having that idea doesn't do you any good, right? You have to pay for it. So he actually had kind of royal blood in his veins, and he did the King of Denmark some favors. And what he got out of that was an island of slaves. So outside of Copenhagen, this island haven was turned over to him. And for 20 years straight, while the same king was in power, he made continuous observations every day. So not kind of randomly when things, you know, when the heavens aligned, as it were. But every day he went out of his way to have his slaves measure the location of everything they could to the maximum possible accuracy. And it's important to recognize this little fact. The telescope hadn't been invented yet. So these are all naked eye observations. And, you know, you can't see perfectly with your eye. You've seen, if you've looked at pictures of the moon from spacecraft, you know that the moon that spacecraft sees looks nothing like the moon you can see with your naked eye. Right? Our moon looks a little bit splotchy, and maybe there's a man in the moon, but I don't think you can pick out craters or anything like what you could see with a spacecraft. So the resolution, your ability to see fine details, roughly speaking, is about a 60th of a degree. Right? And we said that a 60 degree was an arc minute. So I don't know, you can kind of think about that. Remember that your pinky is about a degree, so you're dividing your pinky up into 60 little slices. I think it's pretty believable that that's about as accurately as you can see. So the moon is about half a degree in size. So what we're saying is that kind of at best you've got 30 pixels square on your view of the moon. Things have been blurred to that extent, as opposed to, of course, a picture of the moon from NASA where you have millions of pixels to pick out all of those little craters. Why? Why did Tycho care that much about the heavens? Well, it turned out as a kid, Tycho noticed a nova. So nova means new star. And what this means, currently there's a nova that I've, actually a supernova that I've been studying. So what a nova is it's where there was, where previously you didn't see a dot in the sky, now there is a dot. And for really 300 years, there hasn't been one of these occurrences that you could see with your naked eye. They're pretty rare to be naked eye sorts of objects. But here Tycho saw and noticed one of these things, and also noticed that this contradicted what Aristotle had said, right? Aristotle had said the stars are made out of this eternal stuff. Well, here's a new dot that opened up on this crystalline sphere. It doesn't make sense. So this got him going that Aristotle may well be wrong about how the universe works. This idea of the quintessence may be wrong. And he convinced the king to give him the dollars and islands and slave in order to actually do this work. But He got out of favor with the king, so his observations didn't go on forever. And Tycho himself was, well, he was a pretty good mathematician, but he wasn't a great mathematician. So what he had mostly was huge volumes of data that needed to be analyzed. And now he's not in Denmark. He still had a pretty prestigious situation. What he did is he hired this guy Kepler in order to analyze his data. What exactly did Tycho have in mind? Well, so Tycho didn't believe any of the above. So he didn't believe Copernicus and he didn't believe Aristotle. He had his own kind of point of view. And his point of view, I don't know, sounds maybe kind of funny from the current situation. So his idea was the Earth was the center of the universe. And everything except the moon revolved around, did not revolve around the Earth. It revolved around the sun. So here would be the sun that is still going around the Earth, and we would have Mercury and Venus. Here's the moon. It does go around the Earth. Mercury and Venus go around the sun, and here at greater distances, we'd have Mars going around the sun. And if you think about it, this really isn't that different a system. Right? All he has done is taken the same circles within circles within circles and have declared that the Earth is at rest as opposed to the sun. But I don't know, we can criticize his model, but this is what he thought was going to turn out to be the case when people properly analyzed his data. So one of the requirements he made on Kepler is that Kepler analyze his data with an eye towards his particular model. And of course it's not going to work out really great because it's not true. Okay, so we'll come back to this next time.